Jesse, 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer at kboo.org. That's the annual book and record sale on Sunday, September 14th.
As more and more of our men and women get caught up in the system of mass incarceration, the effect on family members cannot be ignored. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on August 25th at 6:30 p.m. to hear host Amy Johnson speak with members of Mothers of Incarcerated Sons Society. MISS is a group for people who are dealing with the incarceration of a loved one.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, Portland's only community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is our engineer. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate-owned conventional news media. Today, in the second half of today's program, Clayton Morgridge discusses what sort of political movements must be developed to make a real difference in the world. Closing our program, Ivan Hale gives us her thoughts on suicide and depression. Last week on Time Magazine's website, there appeared a controversial opinion piece by none other than basketball legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on the events in Ferguson, beginning with the police execution of an unarmed black teenager. Abdul-Jabbar's article is controversial because it argues that the events in Ferguson are as much about class warfare as about racism. I'm leading off today's program with Abdul-Jabbar's editorial as a way of introduction to Bill Resnick's interview with Kristen Williams on this same subject, which will immediately follow. Abdul-Jabbar's piece is entitled, The Coming Race War Won't Be About Race. Jabbar begins, "Will the recent rioting in Ferguson, Missouri be a tipping point in the struggle against racial injustice, or will it be a minor footnote in some future grad student's thesis on civil unrest in the early 21st century? The answer can be found in May of 1970. You probably have heard of the Kent State shootings. On May 4th, 1970, the Ohio State National Guard opened fire on student protesters at Kent State University. During those 13 seconds of gunfire, four students were killed and nine were wounded, one of whom was permanently paralyzed. The shock and outcry resulted in a nationwide strike of 4 million students that closed more than 450 campuses. 5 days after the shooting, 100,000 protesters gathered in Washington, D.C., and the nation's youth was energetically mobilized to end the Vietnam War, racism, sexism, and mindless faith in the political establishment. You probably haven't heard of the Jackson State shootings on May 14th, 10 days after Kent State ignited a nation. At the predominantly black Jackson State University in Mississippi, police killed two black students, one a high school senior, the other, a father of an 18-month-old baby, with shotguns, and wounded 12 others. There was no national outcry. The nation was not mobilized to do anything. That harshless Leviathan we call history swallowed the event whole, erasing it from the national memory. And unless we want the Ferguson atrocity to also be swallowed and become nothing more than an intestinal irritant to history, we have to address the situation, just as another act of systemic racism, but as what else it is, class warfare. By focusing on just the racial aspect, the discussion becomes about whether Michael Brown's death or that of the other three unarmed black men who were killed by police in the U.S. within that month is about discrimination or about police justification. Then you'll argue about whether there isn't as much black against white racism in the U.S. as there is white against black. Yes, there is. But in general, white against black economically impacts the future of the black community. Black against white has almost no measurable social impact. Then we'll start debating whether or not the police in America are themselves an endangered minority who are also discriminated against based on their color, blue. Yes, they are. There are many factors to consider before condemning police, including political pressures, inadequate training, and arcane policy. Then we'll question whether blacks are more often shot because they more often commit crimes. In fact, studies show that blacks are targeted more often in some cities like New York City. It's difficult to get a bigger national picture because studies are woefully inadequate. This fist-shaking of everyone's racial agenda distracts America from the larger issue that the targets of police overaction are based less on skin color and more on an even worse Ebola-level affliction, being poor. Of course, to many in America, being a person of color is synonymous with being poor, and being poor is synonymous with being a criminal. Ironically, this misconception is true even among the poor. And that's how the status quo wants it. The U.S. Census report finds that 50 million Americans are poor. 50 million voters is a powerful bloc if they ever organized in an effort to pursue their common economic goals. So it's crucial that those in the wealthiest 1% keep the poor fractured by distracting them with emotional issues like immigration, abortion, and gun control, so they never stop to wonder how they got so screwed over for so long. One way to keep these 50 million fractured is through disinformation. Pundit Facts recently scoreboard on network news concluded that a Fox and Fox News channel, 60% of claims are false. At NBC and MSNBC, 40% of claims are deemed false. That's the news, folks. During the Ferguson riots, Fox News ran a black and white photo of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. with a bold caption, "Forgetting MLK's message, protesters in Missouri turned to violence." Did they run such a caption when either President Bush's invaded Iraq? "Forgetting Jesus Christ's message, U.S. forgets to turn cheek and kills thousands." How can viewers make reasonable choices in a democracy if their sources of information are corrupted? They can't, which is exactly how the 1% controls the fate of the 99%. Worse, certain politicians and entrepreneurs conspire to keep the poor just as they are. On his HBO news show Last Week Tonight, John Oliver ran an expose of the payday loan business and those who so callously exploit the desperation of the poor. How does an industry that extorts up to 1,900% interest on loans get away with it? In Texas, State Representative Gary Elkins blocked a regulatory bill, despite the fact that he owns a chain of payday loan stores. And the politician who kept badgering Elkins about his conflict of interest, Representative Vicky Truitt, became a lobbyist for Ace Cash Express just 17 days after leaving office. In essence, Oliver showed how the poor are lured into such a loan, only to be unable to pay it back and having to secure yet another loan. The cycle shall be unbroken. Dystopian books and movies like Snowpiercer, The Giver, Divergent, Hunger Games, and Elysium have been the rage for the past few years, not just because they express teen frustration at authority figures. That would explain some of the popularity among younger audiences, but among the 20-somethings and even older adults also. The real reason we flock to see Donald Sutherland's porcelain portrayal in Hunger Games of a cold, ruthless president of the U.S. dedicated to preserving the rich while grinding his heel into the necks of the poor is that it rings true in a society in which the 1% gets richer, where a middle class is collapsing. That's not hyperbole. Statistics prove this to be true. According to a 2012 Pew Research Center report, just half of U.S. households are middle income, a drop of 11% since the 1970s. Median middle-class income has dropped by 5% in the last 10 years. Total wealth is down 28%. Fewer people, just 23%, think they will have enough money to retire. Most damning of all, fewer Americans than ever believe in the American dream mantra that hard work will get them ahead. Rather than uniting to face the real foe, do-nothing politicians, legislators, and others in power, we fall into a trap of turning against each other, expending our energy battling our allies instead of our enemies. Yes, I'm aware that it is unfair to paint the wealthiest with such broad strokes. There are a number of super-rich people who are also supportive of their community. Humbled by their own success, they reach out to help others. But that's not the case with a multitude of millionaires and billionaires who lobby to reduce food stamps, to give no relief to the burden of student debt on our young, and kill extensions of unemployment benefits. With each of these shootings, chokehold deaths, stand-your-ground atrocities, police and the judicial system are seen as enforcers of an unjust status quo. Our anger rises, and riots demanding justice ensue. News channels interview everyone, and pundits assign blame. Then what? I'm not saying the protests in Ferguson aren't justified. They are. In fact, we need more protests across the country. Where's our Kent State? What will it take to mobilize 4 million students in peaceful protest? Because that's what it will take to avoid actual change. Did I say avoid? I meant evoke actual change. The middle class has to join the poor, and whites have to join African Americans in mass demonstrations, in ousting corrupt politicians, in boycotting exploitative businesses, in passing legislation that promotes economic equality and opportunity, and in punishing those who gamble with our financial future. Otherwise, all we're going to get is what we got out of Ferguson, a bunch of politicians and celebrities expressing sympathy and outrage. If we don't have a specific agenda, a list of exactly what we want to change and how, we'll be gathering over and over again beside the dead bodies of our murdered children, parents, and neighbors. That was an editorial entitled "The Coming Race War Won't Be About Race" by basketball legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Now Bill Resnick interviews Kristen Williams on the Ferguson execution and the ensuing civil unrest. Kristen Williams is a native Portlander and a member of Cop Watch who writes on police behavior. Be advised that on this pre-recorded interview, Resnick was on the phone from New York, and sound quality is not of the best.
Kristen Williams, welcome to KABU.
Hi, Bill. Nice to be here again.
Kristen Williams is a Portlander involved in Cop Watch and Rose City Cop Watch. Began writing on police behavior towards dissidents and the poor, why the police do it, what can be done to protect against police efforts to undermine both the political and what is sometimes called pre-political organizing and struggle by the oppressed and dissidents. His books are Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, and also Hurt, Notes on Torture in a Modern Democracy. So, Christian, how do you understand the killing of Michael Brown, a young black man in Ferguson, Missouri?
Well, I think probably the first thing to say about the death of Michael Brown is how sadly typical it is. I mean, the incident began with the police confronting him and a friend over an extremely minor infraction. They were walking in the street, apparently a street without traffic, so it practically affected no one. The police confronted them about this. There was a very rapid escalation toward violence. It's not exactly clear what happened next, but the ultimate result was that Brown was shot at least six times and killed as a result. And that trajectory, that escalation from very minor infraction to deadly force is often typical of these kinds of police killings, and in particular the ones that create the kind of community outrage. It's also, of course, not incidental to that escalation that Michael Brown was a young African-American man, which probably had something to do with why the officer in question responded as aggressively as he did to, you know, what was really just a couple kids walking in the street.
There's just a huge amount of hassling now, it seems to me, which is somewhat different than the hassling in the past. The law enforcers, whether they be overseers or their owners or paid official police allied with in local government, they're always hassling blacks, it seems to me, and testing them to see whether they'd be obedient or not. And if they were disobedient in any way, that was a sign to, in fact, punish them. Slave narratives, and when the South solidified into black sharecroppers and poor and a white ruling class after Reconstruction, it seems to me, and in the cities of the North throughout the 19th and 20th centuries and continuing, blacks have been hassled. It's sort of become more scientized though, and militarized. It's not just the aggressive cops that do it. It's near all of them. It's part of their required pattern of policing.
Part of my argument in Our Enemies in Blue is that, the function of the police in our society is to preserve existing inequality. Society being stratified as it is by both race and class, that means, in effect, that the police give disproportionate attention to poor people and to people of color in particular, and the history of the country being what it is, to black people especially. And that really goes all the way back to the origin of the institution of the policing, which evolved directly out of the mechanisms to control the slave population in the South. And so we see that lineage continue today with things like racial profiling and with the use of police discretion to especially single out and scrutinize and stop and search and harass and hurt and then arrest and then and sometimes ultimately kill people of color in vastly out of proportion to their share of the population, or for that matter, their share of criminal activity. That's a direct legacy of the history that you were just talking about.
It's still taken a really very frightening scientized turn in the last 15 or 20 years. First, the militarization of the police and their training to apply force. And whenever somebody they find disobedience, as if they back down, they're seen as weak and they're inviting attack. And that's part of police manuals, actually, my understanding. Why don't you discuss that, the militarization of police and also their force application?
One of the initial results of the rioting that we saw in Ferguson was the deployment of the police in combat uniforms, in armored cars, with assault rifles, with sniper rifles, with weapons that look like grenade launchers but were being used to fire tear gas. And that prompted this national debate about the militarization of the police. I mean, really, the riot managed to put that issue on the front page in a way that 20 years of the ACLU worrying about it and activists like me sounding an alarm about it just never did. To understand that militarization, we really need to look back to the unrest of the 1960s. As a result of that unrest, police departments were, first of all, they were terminally embarrassed by having been caught so flat-footed by the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. But they also suffered this huge credibility gap based on the reaction to public protest in that period, and in particular their overreaction to it, since really the only mechanism that they had was to apply force, and often they did so ineffectively. Like the government commissions at the time who investigated police response to demonstrations found over and over again that by responding with overt and sometimes grotesque displays of force, the police did not manage to crush the movements, but often added to their sympathy and escalated situations that would have otherwise been peaceful. So coming out of the 1960s, the police were in this position where they needed to reinvent themselves, and they did so in two major developments of the last 40 years, one of those being militarization, which is partly a matter of the kind of gear that we've seen displayed at Ferguson, but it also represents a change in police tactics, a change in police strategy, and a change in the way that police departments are organized. The second major change coming out of the 60s was the adoption of a philosophy that's called community policing, which means that the police were supposed to create networks within the communities that they were controlling that would create these kinds of partnerships, help them rely less on coercion, also, and not incidentally, provide them better information with what was happening in the neighborhoods, and provide them influence with community leaders who then could be used to channel potential resistance into avenues that could be incorporated into the existing status quo. So move it away from riots and unrests and disruptions of various kinds and into safe institutional channels.
Well, they did try and co-opt leaders and get information. Part of it was sort of this use of soft power and persuasion and integration, as well as getting money to some of the community leaders right through Boys and Girls Clubs and sort of decent things, setting up child care centers, the city would do it, but there'd always be a police function, all of those kinds of soft power. But at the same time, they've begun far more intrusive, it seems to me, like they did with Michael Brown. They are now hassling blacks constantly. They're getting very aggressive at finding black kids who don't want to comply with their orders, and then they face very serious punishment, actually.
So the thing to understand about militarization and community policing is that they're both part of the same overall strategy. In Our Enemies in Blue, I described that as a domestic application of counterinsurgency. In the 10 years since then, the police literature and the military literature has become increasingly explicit on that. So that now the Army is looking at domestic policing as its model for how counterinsurgency is done overseas. So one of the principles of counterinsurgency is that, as important as it may be to identify individual insurgents, it's more important to understand and exercise control over the population as a whole. Domestically, we see that happening in the sense that rather than it being specifically a matter of identifying individual suspects, policing has taken a turn toward focusing on populations as populations. And the U.S. being stratified by race and class, that means they're particularly interested in geographic areas where that are like poor neighborhoods and also neighborhoods that have concentrations of black people. The application then becomes increased scrutiny in those areas. Part of the form that that takes is an application of something that's called the broken windows theory, which is this idea that the way to head off major problems like major crime or major unrest is to focus on the very, very, very small minutia of neighborhood life. And the idea is that very small signs of disorder are actually precursors to the larger disorder. So things like Michael Brown walking in the street, things like people having an open container in public, things like violating smoking regulations, whereas once they would have been maybe a reason for the police to offer you a warning, maybe a citation. In black neighborhoods and poor neighborhoods in particular, they become these opportunities for the police to exercise their full authority, to stop people, to question them, to search them, and basically to escalate this very small infraction, see if they can work it up into a larger charge. The cumulative effect of that kind of policing on a neighborhood over time, first of all, that people often become very afraid of what for the rest of us would just be sort of routine neighborhood life, like going to the store and like, you know, talking to your neighbors in the street and that sort of thing. Those sorts of things attract police attention. The other effect is that it creates what almost 50 years ago now, the Kerner Commission referred to as a reservoir of underlying grievances in the black community, where people increasingly resent the police, resent the presence of the police, resent what they represent. And I think what we're seeing in Ferguson is not just the response to this particular killing, but a response to this whole pattern of police operation.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Christian Williams, who is a national authority on policing. He writes on the depth issues that influence policing. Christian, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the great, great basketball player, probably the tallest great writer in the United States right now. He's about 7'2". He wrote what I thought was a wonderful op-ed describing the Brown killing, talking about it, trying to analyze it. He said, of course, it's racist, but it's also, and in some ways more importantly, part of a pattern of class warfare. He points out the nation's becoming richer and poorer. It's very convenient to demonize blacks. What he could have talked about more was the attack on all dissidents, and not just the black poor, but anybody who really raises their head now. Why don't we start, though, with the demonizing of blacks and how that works into sort of the national understandings?
The racist ideology here, of course, is hundreds of years old at this point, of identifying blackness and criminality. And the police are at least as susceptible to that kind of thinking as anyone else. And so it probably does also shape their interactions with those communities. And in particular, as the strategy and the training teaches them to view particular kinds of populations, poor people and black people in particular, as sort of inherently suspicious and focuses their scrutiny there, that probably also leads them to have more contact with those communities of a kind, with them stopping and hassling them, that then reinforces this narrative in their mind that those communities are inherently suspicious.
And dangerous, it seems to me. That's part of the story, too, why they pump 8 shots into a kid who has already been disabled and is going down. There's so many instances where they just keep shooting. There's something desperately wrong in how police understand even people who somehow disobey them or may, in fact, even seem threatening.
I think in addition to that ideological element, there's also a structural aspect there that the police, both at the individual officer and also at the institutional level, want to maximize their gains and minimize their costs. And so they tend to make decisions that will gain them rewards and minimize the hassle that they face, which rationally leads them to overemphasize policing among relatively powerless people, people who are not going to be in a good position to fight charges, people who are not likely to cause either the officer or the department embarrassment or legal trouble, people who the police then can harass or arrest or bully or hurt without really fearing repercussions. And that doesn't necessarily rely on a self-consciously racist narrative, whites being superior or blacks being inferior, although that may help with that process. It just relies on them responding to the inequality that exists elsewhere in society. Of course, that kind of policing also, and I think this is its main purpose, preserves that inequality and reinforces it. So in addition to the ideological racism, there's also this structural element, which means that to some degree, things like diversity training in police departments or making the police more diverse, which is one of the things that we've heard a lot about in Ferguson, where there are 3 black cops in a police force of about 60. So we've been hearing a lot about the need to diversify the police department. But the truth is, departments that are far more diverse, the Metropolitan Police in Washington, D.C. come to mind, which is majority black force in a majority black city. But they have the same sorts of problems. And in fact, they behave in the same sorts of racist ways. It's not necessarily the attitudes of the individual officers that carry this. They reflect the structural inequality of the society.
Let's discuss the way that the demonization, not just the black poor, but there's the white poor too, who are, because they're poor and a little unruly and their teeth aren't right and often do not respond to police commands in a sort of middle-class way. They're also part of the black poor, at least from the police point of view. They're also dangerous and the rest. It seems what Abdul-Jabbar argues is that this demonization of blacks and the poor and seeing them as dangerous and somehow channeling white fears, you know, fears for their livelihood, a white middle class who has declining income and something even more important, declining security, who are fearful about their kid ever getting a job, but those fears somehow get channeled into fears of crime and fears of the black poor. And Abdul-Jabbar argues that that's really important in splitting blacks and whites. That argument, I think, is very accurate in terms of the political imagination and the way people see themselves in the society in terms of the stratification system.
There's definitely an element of divide and rule there, that by making white people afraid of black people and also sort of perversely having whites resentful of blacks as a threat to their prosperity in some way, it certainly makes it harder for any sort of united class-based response to take form. There's an element of that where some of what people in the sort of middle classes are reacting to is that they have this anxiety about falling into poverty. They're given this meritocratic myth that people who are poor because they deserve it. And from the perspective of slightly privileged people, that's actually very reassuring and also very disciplining, because it keeps them thinking that as long as they keep working hard, as long as they keep playing by the rules, as long as they do what they're told, then they're going to be okay. And if other people aren't okay, then it's probably because they've done something wrong, which then feeds very easily into that narrative of poor people being just sort of inherently criminal. Of course, all the empirical evidence and many people's lived experience goes exactly to contradict that, that hard work and playing by the rules has not been enough to guarantee even a job, much less prosperity or sort of financial comfort. But that myth is very ingrained in our idea of the American dream and the Protestant ethic that's based on, and is very hard for people to shake themselves from, especially when they get some sort of reassurance from thinking that their position is not as precarious as they may fear that it is.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Christian Williams, who's written a great deal on police and policing and its political implications and consequences of the way they do it. One final issue I'd like to talk about in terms of Abdul-Jabbar's sort of notion that this is really part of class warfare. The militarization of police, the power that they now have in many cities, the power to break up groups, to infiltrate groups, to in fact frame leadership, the prosecutor's power to put people away, at least to charge them with huge offenses, and then offer a plea bargain where they'll only serve 2 years, and the lawyers say, look, you could lose this case. We never know. So there's just large numbers of people, in fact, that both are impacted and intimidated by all of that power. Now, all that power aggregated, as Jabbar really didn't discuss that, but it aggregated as a way of, in fact, maintaining power and stopping dissident groups, black dissident groups, labor groups, the great movement around globalization that sort of peaked and became most threatening to them in Seattle. A lot of what's happening now is a response to elite fears that this underclass is somehow going to organize against them. It seems to me that that's also part of the picture.
If we go back for a minute to what I was saying earlier about counterinsurgency, another of the principles of counterinsurgency is that it is better to prevent unrest than to respond to it. One form that that's taken is the sort of community policing stuff and the efforts to offer some conciliatory gestures to make police forces more racially diverse so that they look more like the communities that they're part of, and then also to channel unrest into sort of safe, institutionalized, reformist directions that the system as it presently exists can easily incorporate and manage. The other part of that, though, is that the kind of persistent harassment of the community in general, that scrutinizing and control and coercion of not just individual suspects but entire populations, is partly done as a way of making it harder for people there to organize, people there to create independent kind of centers of resistance. So on the one hand, the neighborhood life and the possibility of resistance is being managed in this way so that the areas of that that the state can control and manage are encouraged, and the areas of that that seem potentially ungovernable are suppressed in advance. And of course, in Ferguson, what we see is, you know, some of the limits of that, where that kind of suppression results in increased resentment and then outright revolt. And then we see the tanks, we see the sniper rifles, we see the body armor, and we realize that the police were preparing for that contingency as well.
Kristen Williams, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Well, thanks for having me on again.
Until the philosophy which owed one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until there are no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, miss a war that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race, it is a war that until that day the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality will remaining but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war. War.
Well, that was Bob Marley with a song he called, not inappropriately, War. And before that, we heard Bill Resnick interview Kristen Williams, who writes on police behavior regarding the civil unrest in Ferguson, Missouri. Next up, Omo Clayton Mortgage shares his thoughts on things to know about organizing.
Today, I'd like to step back from the issues of the moment and ask the very big question, what kind of political movement could make a real difference in the way our world is governed? The human community and the biosphere are governed, controlled, and exploited by a tiny but enormously wealthy elite who have no goals other than to maintain their power and increase their profits. Neoliberalism is the ideology that rationalizes this plutocracy, the doctrine that the rights of private property should take precedence over concerns for any larger community, that government should be minimal and neither tax nor regulate the enterprises of individuals and corporations. Individuals should succeed or fail in the competitive world without public support. Neoliberals, however, do want a government with a big security apparatus to put down any resistance that might arise against the elites, as we just heard from Christian Williams and Bill Resnick. Over the last several years, it has become obvious that this way of running the world is leaving millions in poverty and insecurity, while the wealthy few get wealthier by the minute, and the earth slouches on towards environmental collapse. Even if the economy should improve and put more people back to work, the underlying insecurity remains, and more greenhouse gases are pumped into the sky. What kind of a political movement could be equal to the radical task of changing the direction in which we are headed? Sam Gindin has some suggestions in an article called Unmaking Global Capitalism, 9 Things to Know About Organizing in the Belly of the Beast, published in the current issue of Jacobin magazine. I'm going to discuss just 2 of these things. First, austerity and bad news do not make people question the status quo. Speaking of the waves of cuts associated with Reagan and Thatcher, but that began even earlier, he writes, "The frustrations of austerity did not generally lead to radicalization, but only increased pressures on working-class families to maintain as much consumption as they could. Without collective solutions, they found other ways to support themselves, thereby undermining the development of the working class as an oppositional class. Family members extended their hours of work, students also became full-time workers, and young couples moved in with their families. The ironic outcome of these forms of survival was that they contributed to reproducing the very neoliberal sense of individualism that has so damaged working-class lives." As people were forced by austerity to rely only on themselves, they increasingly thought of themselves as independent and self-sufficient, and that everyone else ought to be as well. So, picket lines and street protests faded in relevance, and cultures of solidarity and collective capacities to struggle atrophied. This further divided workers. Workers doing relatively well resented paying taxes on their hard-earned income to support those on welfare, while welfare recipients and the unemployed were bitter about unions who ignored their plight. The lesson, then, is that crisis-mongering as a mechanism for overcoming political apathy is to be avoided. Gindin writes, "Continuously declaring that a decisive crisis is around the corner may generate attention, but it may just as well scare people and bring out their most conservative instincts. It may lower expectations and make people long for the way things used to be, desperately hoping to fix, not transform, or even significantly modify capitalism. We cannot depend on crises to do our political work for us. If we think that capitalism is a system that blocks human progress, then the challenge is to convince people that capitalism is the problem even when it is working at its best. A related tendency is that of environmental catastrophism. To be sure, the climate crisis must be decisively confronted. But declarations that the end of the planet is only decades away, if capitalism isn't radically changed now, may just reinforce a sense that we are doomed and can't really do anything about it. A better way to address the environmental crisis would be to frame the issue of the environment around a broader struggle that includes the redistribution of income and wealth to more equitably share the costs of environmental restraint, and a cultural shift in the balance between individual consumption of goods and collective services. Now, the second thing Sam Gindin wants us to know about organizing in the belly of the beast is that our politics must ultimately reckon with state power if we are to confront power where it is most concentrated. It's no good just protesting capitalism. It must be replaced. And that requires, quoting again, transforming state institutions in the deepest democratic sense, imagining and struggling for a state whose main function at national, regional, and municipal levels would no longer be to defend and advance the interests of capital, but would be to support and develop our collective capacities to democratize the economy and all aspects of our lives. Now, this goal demands a politics that goes beyond the horizontal and spontaneous forms of organizing that characterized the Occupy movement. Quoting again, "The glorification within these movements of spontaneity and fragmentation comes close to mirroring neoliberalism's own drive to freer markets, individualism, and a workforce that has no stability or roots. There seems to be a notion that radical change will evolve out of the accumulation of protests, and so little attention is paid to developing a deeper analysis of events. Occupy's refusal to put forth a program was at first a stroke of tactical genius, because it implied that the problem was not a specific issue, but the system as a whole. But in terms of longer-term movement building, this refusal soon became a severe liability. This style of mobilization can bring people out, but it cannot organize them into a movement that builds and sustains an ever-expanding collective power. Absent such structures, democracy is reduced to forms of dialogue, not shared agreements. A purely horizontal politics blocks decisive collective action, and we wind up with permanent protest instead of a politics of transformative change." Identity politics emerged in the 1970s, in part out of the failures of the left to speak to and integrate specific oppressions into class politics, those of women and African Americans in particular. But while identity politics often added to and strengthened working class politics, it also included a dangerous tendency to push the salience of class aside. It was bitterly ironic that at the very moment the state mounted a comprehensive attack on working class power, identity politics was parsing the working class into ever more fragmented subgroups. Though identities obviously matter a great deal, they cannot combine into a new politics because their essence is their separateness. Something else is needed to bring them together in a broader, more integrated, and more coherent politics, something beyond the particularistic concerns of both identities and unions. That something is class." End of quote. So, the project of the left in educating and organizing must be learning to perceive, feel, think, and act around the fact that we are all subjected to capital, and only a movement that organizes on that basis has any chance of replacing capitalism with a world that works for all of us. I've been talking about and reading from Sam Gindin's piece, Unmaking Global Capitalism, from the current issue of Jacobin magazine. We'll post a link to the whole, much longer article when today's Old Mole is posted online. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. The world was greatly saddened by the news of Robin Williams' suicide earlier this month. Although any person has the right to take his or her own life, it is a tragic event for both the individual and especially for those left behind. With broader societal discussion and proper support, it is a highly preventable tragedy. Now Ivan Hale is here to discuss suicide and depression, which apparently drove Williams to his desperate act.
Good morning. When I was 9 years old, I read a page in my mom's diary stating she was contemplating suicide. I remember the moment well. We were living in a dilapidated 19th-century brick rental house in a small town in southern Oregon. The kitchen was in the basement, as was the living room and bathroom. I was home alone playing Bob Marley and the Wailers on the record player and dancing around the tiny space chuffed full of ferns, candles, and shabby vintage furniture when I spied her simple spiral notebook sitting near an incense burner. I knew my mom wrote her thoughts daily in this book, and being only 9, well, I got curious. My mom wasn't diagnosed with chronic major depression until well after her first bout when she was just 19 years old. Languishing in a small logging town in eastern Oregon, working as a clerk for the Forest Service as my dad worked in the local sawmill, my mom, already consumed with malaise, began to experience the associated but then unknown physical symptoms of depression. Sleep changes, loss of appetite, feelings of helplessness, unfocused panic attacks, debilitating anxiety. After several trips to the local hospital with no results and no changes, my mom traveled to see her uncle, a doctor in San Francisco. She was put through a battery of procedures, exams, tests, and x-rays, and despite her certainty of a terminal illness, no causes for her symptoms could be found. It was 1961, and Americans were far from enlightened on depression and its impacts on the body and mind. My mom recalls one doctor in San Francisco, though, actually asking her about her home life, the implication being that perhaps her problems were not physical. But it would be 30 more years before she would get on and stay on antidepressant medication, and that with only mixed results. The recent death of Robin Williams has brought to the national forefront, once again, the reality that clinical depression can in fact be a terminal illness. According to the National Institute for Mental Health, depression is correlated to 2/3 of the 30,000 suicide cases a year in the United States. Approximately 16 million people over the age of 18 experience one major episode of clinical depression over the course of 12 months. Depression is also considered a worldwide epidemic, according to the World Health Organization, with 5% of the global population suffering from the condition. And the statistics, they say, are rising. But I cannot read these statistics without questioning the extent to which the pharmaceutical companies benefit from all these cases of depression, as Western concepts of mental illness and its subsequent treatment become the global model. Which is not to say that I don't believe in the true suffering mental illness in general and depression in particular can cause. I see it every day in my work, and I know it from personal experience. It's pretty well known now that children born to depressed mothers are predisposed themselves to experience depression at some point in their lives. This lucky break, as well as plenty of life trauma, contributed to my first experience of major depression, not coincidentally, when I was just 19 years old. Depression is often viewed as a bootstrap illness, something the person should be able to pull themselves out of. Get over it, they say. Cheer up. Oh, it's not that bad. Or my favorite, it's all in your head. But unlike sadness, a feeling state, depression is visceral. As one comedian quipped, it's not like chickenpox, where you get it once and then are forever immune. It's more like herpes. It never entirely goes away, will manifest in times of stress, and really mess up your sex life. In my last bout of depression, my world took on a Polaroid hue of washed-out colors and hyperreal images. Even sunny days felt oppressive and menacing. There was a constant taste of iron in my mouth. I could barely eat, the anxiety turning even oatmeal to acid. Every step I took in the world among people was like being the only person in slow motion, while everything else sped by in a blur I couldn't touch or connect with. So loud was my depression that I could barely concentrate on what people were saying to me, which made me feel freakish and abnormal and separated. I wanted to never leave my room, but my room became a trap, where the walls tugged my breath away and constricted my lungs. I could not breathe, I could not move, I could not rest, I could not sleep. That is depression. That is what they mean when they list symptoms as, quote, feelings of hopelessness or helplessness, appetite or weight changes, sleep changes, loss of interest in daily activities. I know. I should not be so hard on Western medicine, Western society's attempts to describe something so hideous. I mean, if I picked up a brochure on depression that read, "You may experience feelings of falling through black existential voids while being suffocated by your own thoughts as you grind your teeth to the gums," I would probably run screaming to the nearest tall bridge and jump. Ah, but that is what we're not supposed to do. People with depression are often viewed as selfish and self-centered, and so are people who commit suicide. We look down upon those that kill themselves as having given up, lost the fight, failed. The negative construction of suicide in the West plays out in movies and literature, from Dante's The Divine Comedy, where suicide souls are placed in a particularly awful hell, to the movie Beetlejuice that condemned all suicides to be civil servants in their afterlife, a fate worse than death. It's the very Christian idea that people who kill themselves are somehow punished for playing God. As a social worker, I am empowered with the ability to remove a person's rights temporarily if they are deemed a threat to themselves or others. It is the mental health worker's prime directive to stop a person from ending their own life, even if that means having that person taken away by police in handcuffs to the nearest hospital and held there against their will for 48 hours. And I don't mean stop them from being about to pull the trigger. I mean stop them if they have been assessed as a suicide risk, experiencing what we call suicidal ideation, or SI. Because in the eyes of community mental health, to even think about killing yourself means you are a sick person who needs help. We are told in trainings, seminars, workshops, etc., that a person planning suicide is not in their right mind. They are not thinking clearly, they are sick. And that it is a mental health provider's prerogative to get them stabilized, thinking clearly again so that they do not want to kill themselves. What I'm not saying here is how much these decisions have to do with liability and avoiding lawsuits, but that is another story. So, according to Western society, a person who experiences extreme mental suffering, lives in bug-infested subsidized housing, sleeps on a dirty mattress on a floor covered with cigarette butts and lice, subsists on food line meals and $60 a week from Social Security, and takes antipsychotic medication that can cause debilitating neurological side effects, should be stopped by all means necessary from ending their own life. And a person who is experiencing lifelong debilitating depression, is a famous movie actor or brilliant comedian, should by all means be stopped from killing themselves. And if neither of these people want to be stopped, we should take away their rights and put them in the hospital, because at least then they will be alive. If suicide was an accepted way out, would simply knowing that option was possible relieve some of the suffering? What will the impact of the globalization of mental illness and depression and suicide be? Will seppuku, the ritual suicide in Japanese culture that has been honored for centuries, be condemned? Will monks that set themselves on fire in protest for the decimation of their country, their religion, their way of life, be body tackled before they light the flame and taken to the nearest hospital for psychiatric assessment? Are these monks not in their right minds? Are suicide bombers not in their right minds? Was Robin Williams tired of his existence and ready to take some power back over the helplessness he felt for much of his life? Or was he not in his right mind? We call depression a mental illness, but we don't treat it like an illness. We don't treat it like the cancer it really is. And we can never ask a person who successfully commits suicide if they are happy with the results. I feel incredibly lucky that the medication I finally decided to take after 15 years into my depression actually worked. It changed my life, but many are not so fortunate. In my major bouts of depression, my mom has always been my biggest and best ally. Maybe it's because we share genes, but maybe it's also because she understands depression better than anyone I know. She is now on her sixth decade of adult chronic depression. Her resiliency is stunning, and I watch as she sets her jaw and musters forward through each day. When I was a kid, I had a consistent fear of her death. She would reassure me by saying she was too mean to die. At 72 years old, my mom's had a hell of a life. She has survived trauma and abuse and tremendous suffering. And she is more than worthy of respect and dignity in life as well as in death. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Ivan Hale.
Even though clouds white curtain in a far-off corner flared, and the hypnotic splattered mist was slowly lifting. Electric light still struck like arrows fired but far the ones condemned to drift or else be kept from drifting. Calling for the searching ones on a speechless seeking trail, for the lonesome hearted lovers with too personal a tale. And for each unharmful gentle soul misplaced inside a jail. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Starry-eyed and laughing, as I recall when we were caught, trapped by no track of ours, for they hang suspended. As we listened one last time, and we watched with one last look, spellbound and swallowed till the tolling ended. Tolling for the aching whose wounds cannot be nursed, or the countless confused accused misused, strung out ones and worse. And for every hung up person in the whole wide universe, and we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well, can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. And this is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Portland. Coming up next, it's Air Cascadia with cutting-edge news, views, and just plain horse sense with Chris Andre. At 10:15 is Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest, Elizabeth Colbert, author of the book The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. At 11, we'll hear Disability Awareness with our host Grace Eagle Reed, a monthly show about issues affecting people with disabilities and their communities.
is proud to co-sponsor
Negative Land.
Performing live Friday, August 29th at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside in Portland.
We got so much power.
How many time zones there are in the Soviet Union?
Since 1980, Negative Land has been creating records, CDs, video, fine arts, books, radio, and live performance using appropriated sounds, images, objects, and texts.
Negative Land will be performing with Daniel Mensch and Cascadian Knights. All ages welcome.
Not even funny.
Again, that's Negative Land, Friday, August 29th at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside in Portland.
More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The loudspeaker spoke up and said,
good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, August 25th, 2014. And you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. And what time is it? Time to be a member. If you are not already a member, and the listeners are, of course, beloved, welcome, and part of the community. But a membership is what makes all of this come together. So thank you, members, and welcome new members. Just go ahead and click on that button and make it happen. Today, we have two guests and very little time as always, so we're going to try to get to that very quickly. We will be speaking with Mazen Khamsia in Occupied Palestine. His voice is one of the most articulate and impassioned voices coming out of that troubled area. More violence on the part of the Israeli Defense Forces. The mainstream media, including public media,